Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would now like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Stephanie, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop, and this workshop is titled Update from the 2016 ASH, or American Society of Clinical, American Society of Hematology Annual Meeting, and this is a program that we offer every year after that meeting, and it really provides an update on for all the different blood cancers, and so it's something that I know many of you look forward to every year. This is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations and blood cancer organizations as well. And it really is because of that collaboration we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. So we have over 952 participants on the call today. You come from all over the United States. And we also have international participants from Australia, Canada, China, Costa Rica, France, Ireland, Italy, Morocco, and Pakistan. So you really come from all over the world. It's amazing and that you've chosen to spend the next hour with us. Now, today's program is supported by the Celgene Corporation, a grant from Genentech, Gilead, and Novartis Oncology. And I really want to thank them for their support of the program and also for their collaborative partnership and working together to support the program. And we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. John Leonard. And Dr. Leonard is the Richard T. Silver Distinguished Professor of Hematology and Medical Oncology, Associate Dean for Clinical Research, Weill Cornell Medical College, Vice Chairman for Clinical Research, Weill Department of Medicine, Associate Director of Clinical Trials, Sondra and Edward Mayer, Cancer Center at Weill Cornell Medicine, Attending Physician Chief Lymphoma Service, New York Presbyterian, and he's Director of the Joint Clinical Trials Office at Weill Cornell Medicine and New York Presbyterian. And Dr. Lennon is going to present to you the purpose of the American Society of Hematology, or ASH, annual meeting, an overview of blood cancer, lymphoma-specific treatment and research updates from ASH, and the role of clinical trials and how research advances treatment options. It's my pleasure now to turn this call over to Dr. Leonard.
Thank you very much, Carolyn, and it's a pleasure to be here today working as part of this program and with my colleagues who really represent experts in these fields that we're dealing with today. So the American Society of Hematology is really the largest organization in the world, to my knowledge, that is a group, an association of physicians, of researchers, of really all of the different organizations, whether they're patient advocacy or pharmaceutical companies or others doing research in hematology, hematology referring to blood diseases, and that refers to the entire range of blood disorders such as sickle cell anemia, thalassemia, abnormal blood clotting issues, abnormal blood count issues, all of the diseases of the blood, including the blood cancers, which are really the focus of our discussion here today, lymphoma, tumors of the lymph system, the lymph cells, leukemia, tumors of the blood cells of a different type generally, the myeloproliferative neoplasms, which are groups of diseases that relate to abnormal growth of the bone marrow, and multiple myeloma, which relates to a cancer of bone marrow cells called plasma cells. So this is the blood cancer area is really a major focus of the American Society of Hematology meeting, and I would say if you add up all of the items being presented, the blood cancers as a group really in number represent a large part of the activity. So the meeting is a place where physicians come to learn about what's new and where collaborators get together to try to develop new approaches, new research projects, new treatments. And investigators, researchers who are working in the field developing new therapies come to present their work and to learn from each other and to talk about ways to move forward. So it's a very exciting meeting, and I know all of us participating today really look at it as a highlight of our calendar to meet with our colleagues and hear what's going on and obviously present things that we think are exciting that we're working on. So my task in the next few minutes is to talk to you a bit about lymphoma, tumors of the blood cancers that relate to the lymph nodes primarily. These can also sometimes affect the blood, but are basically primarily cancers of the lymph nodes. And the challenging thing in blood cancers and lymphoma specifically is that there's so many different types. And in fact, the World Health Organization, which organizes various ways to help advance disease, the treatment and prevention of various diseases, has recently organized an update of the classification of blood cancers, or the diseases we're talking about today, and there are over 100 different types of blood cancers, and if you start to get into the various different subtypes defined by genetic abnormalities, I think this can easily run into several hundred, if not thousands, of these diseases if we start to take the pie of patients and disorders and put them in the smaller groups. So that is good news because it means we're delivering on the promise of precision therapy, meaning we are subsetting groups of patients and not treating everyone the same. And we are also, I think, being more precise in our diagnosis. And I think you'll hear that as a theme in the presentations today, is that obviously we want to pick the right treatment for the right patient, avoid side effects by giving the wrong treatment to certain patients because we misdiagnose them one way or another, and obviously giving the treatments the best chance and our patients the best chance to know what to expect out of these disorders. So briefly, I'm just going to hit the high points in lymphoma. One area is diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. That's the most common type of lymphoma. It's about a third of patients with lymphoma have diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. And this is an area that is standardly treated with a combination of an antibody treatment called rituximab plus a combination of chemotherapy called CHOP. And I want to highlight just a couple trials in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma that I think are important if you're a patient or family member dealing with this. One is that R-CHOP can cure the majority of patients with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. Are there ways we can tweak R-CHOP to try to make it work better? There are two big trials that were presented at ASH. I'll present them briefly. One is a trial of the standard R-CHOP therapy in newly diagnosed patients with large cell aggressive lymphoma compared to a more complicated regimen given over 5 days rather than 1 day every 3 weeks. It also adds a drug called etoposide. This newer regimen is called dose-adjusted R-EPOC. I won't spend much time on it because the point of the study is that it looked at this more complicated regimen, compared it to the standard R-CHOP, and the net is that there's no difference. So for most patients, not all, there are a few exceptions, but for most patients with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, this study showed that R-CHOP continues to be a standard treatment. There was a different trial that took the R-CHOP regimen and compared it to a new version of rituximab. Again, rituximab is what's called a monoclonal antibody, an immune protein that binds to something called CD20 on lymphoma cells. And that new antibody called obinutuzumab, it's a mouthful, obinutuzumab with CHOP was compared to R-CHOP in a large cell aggressive lymphoma. Again, no difference between the two. So for large cell aggressive lymphoma, R-CHOP remains the standard. Now, I'm going to come back to this obinutuzumab antibody in just a minute because it may be more applicable to other lymphoma subtypes. We have, before we leave large cell lymphoma, I'll mention that there were some data suggesting that a drug called lenalidomide, which is a pill, is a drug called lenalidomide or Revlimid. You may hear a little bit more about because it's also used in myeloma, so you may hear about that touched on in a later talk. Lenalidomide has some activity, some utility in patients with large cell lymphoma in the relapse setting and is being used in clinical trials. And so there were some studies presenting a little bit more data on lenalidomide in large cell lymphoma, more to come in that with further clinical trials. And then finally, in large cell lymphoma, I'll mention a study of a novel technology many patients with blood cancers may have heard about it called CAR T-cells. This is a fancy way to essentially take T-cells, immune cells from the patient, collect them from the patient, engineer them in the laboratory so that they are better at fighting cancer cells, reinfusing them back into the patient, and then trying to use those new re-engineered immune T cells from the patient, in this case they're called CAR T cells, to try to make the tumor shrink. There are studies of this in relapsed patients with aggressive lymphoma, like diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. You may hear this alluded to in some of the other talks because it is relevant to other blood cancers. The net in CAR T cells, my conclusion is that the jury is still out. There are lots of clinical trials. There are some side effects to these treatments, including some neurologic, some brain, temporary brain-related side effects that rarely can be life-threatening. So this is not always an easy treatment and often a bit complicated. Nonetheless, this is a very exciting technology in clinical trials, and I think time will tell. Pay attention to this for relapsed patients. This is not something that someone who's newly diagnosed really needs to consider at this point, but over time, we'll see how this pans out as a treatment, and there's a lot of enthusiasm about it in various blood cancers, including lymphoma. I next want to move to follicular lymphoma. This is the most common of the indolent lymphomas. There were two studies presented of this new version of rituximab called obinutuzumab, I mentioned. This is, again, a re-engineered version of rituximab that's engaged or developed primarily to activate the immune system in different ways, potentially better ways. And there was a trial using obinutuzumab plus chemotherapy versus rituximab plus chemotherapy, a very common treatment, standardly now in follicular lymphoma. And then both groups received maintenance treatment with the antibody over about 2 years. And the net of this trial, called the Gallium trial, which was presented at the meeting in the plenary session, one of the large sessions that got a lot of attention, basically showed that this new version of rituximab, obinutuzumab, seemed to keep people in remission longer. It didn't make them live longer, at least at this point in time, but it did keep them in remission longer, a modest, I would say, difference. And it did have a little bit more in the way of side effects. So this is something that is also now available and approved in the relapse setting for patients in combination with a drug called bendamustine. So the net is that in follicular lymphoma, patients have another option beyond rituximab called obinutuzumab. It's an antibody treatment that is a newer version of rituximab. It may be a bit better than rituximab in some cases, again, in the follicular type. I don't think personally it's a dramatic major leap forward, but I think it's a modest step forward for some patients and something that patients should at least ask their doctor about as a possibility. I just want to end on two quick things. I want to mention that patients with mantle cell lymphoma, a different type of lymphoma, sometimes are treated with chemotherapy with rituximab. Sometimes they get stem cell transplants, aggressive therapy with rituximab. There was a study at the ASH meeting suggesting that if you are a mantle cell patient getting a stem cell transplant, you may want to think about maintenance rituximab after your stem cell transplant, again, for mantle cell lymphoma. That study showed that there might be actually an overall survival benefit, meaning how long people live. So again, mantle cell patients getting a stem cell transplant only in that situation may benefit particularly from maintenance rituximab, worth asking your doctor. So with that, I think I will stop. At the end of my time, there's a lot of other things happening. I would encourage you to seek out additional sources. Ask your doctor if you're dealing with a different type of lymphoma, because there are a lot of new things happening and a lot of new clinical trials. Everything I've mentioned to you and the other physicians speaking today mentioned to you are information that we can give to you because patients and physicians have participated in clinical trials that take our standard treatments and try to make them better or offer new drugs that in some cases, although of course not all, in some cases may be the new standard treatments for tomorrow that are now available as part of clinical trials. So again, these are things that it's very important to ask your doctor about. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you very much. Dr. Leonard, that was really outstanding and really excellent and introduction also to the whole program, but also a wonderful focus on lymphomas, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well, so thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Michael Morrow. Dr. Morrow is leader of myeloproliferative neoplasms program, attending physician leukemia service, member of Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, professor of medicine, Law Cornell Medical College. And Dr. Morrow is going to address an overview of leukemia, leukemia-specific treatment and research updates from ASH, and key questions to ask your healthcare team about your treatment. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Morrow.
Well, thank you, everyone, and thank you, Carolyn, for inviting me and my colleagues to join everyone today. I have a bit of a big task in just the next 10 minutes or so to cover all of leukemia, but I'll start by just describing what we talk about when we hear the word leukemia, which, of course, is a hard diagnosis to hear, but there clearly are different types of leukemia, acute and chronic, and we generally divide them into four categories. Acute leukemia into a myeloid or a lymphoid type, and that's depending on the cell that we believe is causing the condition and it's damaged. And the chronic leukemia is, again, either lymphoid or myeloid. One important thing to point out is that related to the discussion we just heard about Dr. Leonard, within the lymphoid cancer, CLL is unique in that there are certain circumstances where that diagnosis of CLL may not need to be immediately treated. For certain patients with very limited evidence of their condition or certain circumstances, observation may be warranted, and that's careful observation, of course, before treatment may be necessary. And these chronic forms of leukemia, of course, can be long in duration, and so that may make some sense. The other leukemia is chronic myeloid leukemia, acute myeloid and acute lymphoid leukemia warrant treatment after the diagnosis is made, and they are treated differently. I spent a lot of time in research in chronic myeloid leukemia, and I'm glad to say that we've made some very great advances in that disease and have now turned a diagnosis that generally would be lasting over several years into a potentially functionally curable type of leukemia and highly treatable. But we're really making progress in all leukemias. The way they're diagnosed, generally from blood tests, but symptoms often are the warning shot, particularly signs of bleeding or infection or fatigue, bruising, as one might expect, and seeing a leukemia expert, and of course, nowadays, with the way we're able to profile leukemias, understanding exactly what makes the leukemia tick has become paramount. So that's a bit of an overview for leukemia. I'd like to share some of the highlights or the things that were brought out in recent meetings, particularly ASH, regarding leukemia. And I'll start by talking about acute myeloid leukemia. And getting back to the first point I made about how we look at acute myeloid leukemia, historically, we knew it was a diagnosis of the blood, a leukemia of the blood, and we would generally look at available technology to understand the type of cell that it was and perhaps some of the things that had gone wrong with that cell, particularly the chromosomes or the genetics. But we've made a huge advance with our ability to understand the human genome, and we now are able to classify AML and ALL to a degree with much greater precision, and we can look at the genetics, the chromosomes, the blueprints, essentially, that are in the cell to see if they're structurally abnormal or if there have been exchanges or what are called translocations. But more importantly, we can look at what are called molecular markers, switches, I like to call them, that are either turned on or turned off, or things that are not doing what they're supposed to or doing things they aren't supposed to be doing in the cell. And there's a list of things that are what I would say are routinely clinically useful in AML. Some of their names are FLT3, NPM1, CEBP, CKIT, IDH, a bunch of acronyms, which may not make much sense if you're not in the healthcare profession, but they're definitely things that if someone has leukemia, that they're very helpful to make the diagnosis more precise by understanding what the expectation for treatment response may be, what medications could be useful, and maybe what the best treatment plan to hopefully have a curative approach will be. We can divide patients into groups, and some of these genetic markers are actually favorable, so they might allow patients to have a course of treatment that may be different than other patients and spare them from needing more intensive therapy in some cases. So it's very important. Turning to the ASH meeting and targeted therapy in this area, I'll mention a few drugs and a few studies that have highlighted this type of benefit in our knowledge. First would be targeting something called FLT3. To explain what FLT3 is quite simply, and it'll make sense to almost anyone who hears this, it's essentially that the switch that tells the blood cell to grow a stimulant or growth factor. Instead of being able to be switched on and off with a message to grow, it's on all the time. So if there's a mutation or an alteration in FLT3, the cells think they're supposed to be growing and dividing all the time. So there was a very important study using a drug called midostaurin, which showed that we were able to improve the survival of patients with leukemia if we simply added that to the chemotherapy we use now. So that was a landmark study that we need to pay attention to and make that our standard or incorporate that as our standard. Another target has emerged, which has been a bit of a discovery, called IDH. And this is an enzyme that's in the cells normally, and it's related to how they their intracellular machinery, or how cells process energy, and what's called the mitochondria. And abnormality in IDH can lead to a leukemic behavior in cells. So, and IDH inhibitors have been developed. And there are multiple forms to target different types of alterations in this IDH, and have proven very successful with a significant fraction of patients with an oral medication being able to have leukemia response or even remission. And it's interesting that it doesn't just destroy the leukemia cells, but it can cause them to differentiate or revert back to a normal type of activity. A third target might be what's called BCL2, and I think Dr. Lennon may have alluded to this. Is quite familiar with this target, which we know is active or an issue in both lymphoid and myeloid cancers. So in acute leukemia, we've borrowed from our therapies in lymphoid cancers with a drug called venetoclax, which is a drug which restores the ability of cells to understand that it's time to die, time to go, especially if they're a leukemia cell. And by using this inhibitor of BCL2 called venetoclax, in combination with drugs we use in leukemia, like drugs like Bidaza or decitabine, 5-azacitabine was the generic name for the first drug, those are called hypomethylating agents, or with lower doses of chemotherapy, we can have a regimen that's perhaps better tolerated than stronger chemotherapy and proves effective in patients with leukemia and dysplasia. One last target to mention would be, or a drug to mention would be a drug called vadatuximab, which is an antibody against something that most leukemia cells have on the surface, plus something that gets into their DNA and destroys the cell's ability to proliferate and grow and divide. This is an antibody which seems to be quite powerful and has good data in clinical trials. There's some investigation ongoing to make sure that the side effect profile is better understood, because many patients go on to bone marrow transplant after leukemia, and I think that we need more time to understand that better, but that's another exciting advance. A few other things to mention in acute myeloid leukemia that are different strategies where we've used things, we've adapted the immune system or things that are normally in cells. And two things to mention would be the combination of a drug called nivolumab, which is an immune active drug, which is essentially called a checkpoint inhibitor, which is best described as taking the brakes off our own immune system, allowing it to help participate in the clearance and the identification of a damaged cell that's part of leukemia. And in combination with, again, the hypomethylating agents, there's a study I actually showed very good activity. So we're moving immunotherapy into AML in that way. And lastly, a very interesting drug which helps restore the normal tumor suppressor gene in cells called P53. And it's a mouthful, as Dr. Leonard alluded to. It's a drug called DS3032B. And think of it as a drug that cooperates with the normal protein that can still be normal in cells called P53, although that often is damaged. But when it's there and it's not able to be active to help control cancer or treat it, we now have a drug that can turn that back on. Lastly, in AML, we're also using supportive care drugs, and there's a medication called eltrombopag, which helps platelets grow. It's a mimic of this signal that tells our body to make more platelets, and when someone's recovering from chemotherapy with AML, that can be quite useful to shorten the amount of time people have low platelets. I'm going to turn in the last few minutes to the other types of leukemia. I'll turn next to perhaps my favorite, which is CML. And from NASH, I think we learned two important things, although we, of course, learned many things. First is that we have yet more work to do with regard to new drugs, and a drug called ABLE-001, which is now the fourth generation of oral medicines that help treat chronic myeloid leukemia by targeting the abnormal protein in leukemia cells in CML called BCR-ABL. And what's unique about this drug is it works not, by the way, the 5 current drugs that are available work, but slightly differently. It turns off the same protein by a different approach. It blocks something called the myristoyl escalation site rather than the kinase domain. And this drug is an oral drug, just like the other TKIs or oral drugs for CML, and the phase 1 study appears to be very safe and has very promising activity. So look for more on that drug as it expands in its early trials and moves into later trials, comparing to other drugs and even being brought earlier into therapy for CML as a potential way to stop resistance or to treat patients better. The second thing we learned in CML was that as we undergo the careful experiment of stopping treatment in patients who have had a very good response, have had a long enough period on treatment, which is several years, and have the right type of response, that we're trying to find just the right length of time, that's the minimum that's required, in order to maximize the chances of success. And a large study from Europe called the EuroC trial showed us that most patients should have treatment for in the neighborhood of 5 years and be in a deep remission for in the neighborhood of 3 years before such an endeavor is considered. And that's exciting that that can be done, but we have to temper our excitement and be patient. It is a marathon running the race of CML. And now that in the U.S. in our guidelines we have the ability to consider treatment discontinuation, I'd urge patients and caregivers and providers as well to look carefully at the guidelines and to only consider that under the right circumstances and to stay current on our research, which is telling us what might be the optimal time to think about that. This is a very good story, and it's going to have a very good ending. And turning to the lymphoid leukemias, I'll keep my comments brief as my time is running short. In CLL, which I think many of the things Dr. Lander mentioned in lymphoma have some relevance to chronic lymphocytic leukemia, but at ASH, I think we saw very nice information telling us that the drug also mentioned lenalidomide, which works probably by modulating the immune system as well, can help CLL patients if it's used as maintenance after their first chemotherapy to get them in remission, to prolong that remission. I think that's important data to pay attention to. And also the medication venetoclax, which I said we borrowed and used in AML. When we use it in CLL for patients who have particularly a loss or damage of the P53 gene, seems to be quite effective. With regards to ALL, I would say that probably the most exciting development there and data presented at ASH is around CAR T-cell therapy. So patients both with and without the Philadelphia chromosome, mainly those without, but those with as well, who have failed chemotherapy and have maybe limited treatment, are able to benefit from CAR T-cell therapy. But much as Dr. Leonard had mentioned, the side effects of that treatment need to be better understood. Some of the important trials in that area are currently on pause as we look carefully at the way these immune therapies are performed with regards to engineering the T-cells and how they're delivered back to patients, and particularly the central nervous system side effects or brain side effects. The last point I want to make is that as a leukemia patient, caregiver, survivor, physician, we all need to know as much as we can about our diagnosis. So I think the probably most important thing in 2017 to remind people is to know as much as you can about your leukemia, because we clearly have raised the bar and uncovered a lot more information about the molecular and genetic underpinnings of leukemia. And those are really important bits of data that can help us understand medication options, sometimes lower side effect types of options, how the leukemia is going to behave, and how we can really maximize our chances of cure. Thank you for your attention.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Morrow. That was really excellent. And thank you for addressing all of leukemias so comprehensively. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A, so thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Ruben Mesa. Dr. Mesa is consultant hematologist, Mayo Clinic in Arizona. He is chair, Division of Hematology and Medical Oncology, and deputy director, Mayo Clinic Cancer Center, professor of medicine. And Dr. Mesa is going to address an overview of myeloproliferative neoplasms, or MPN, MPN-specific treatment and research updates from ASH, and talking with the health team about your treatment options. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Mesa.
Well, many thanks, Carolyn. It's always a great pleasure to participate in these teleconferences. I certainly hope that they're helpful for the individuals listening in. I certainly hope to build on the excellent discussion already held by my wonderful colleagues, John Leonard and Mike Morrow, in terms of organizing several themes. Now, the myeloproliferative neoplasms are a group of chronic leukemias in parallel to the discussion that Mike nicely held regarding the more aggressive or acute leukemias. In the myeloproliferative neoplasms, specifically, we're talking about three diseases: essential thrombocythemia, polycythemia vera, and myelofibrosis. And there's some less common ones that I'll quickly make comment of as well. Now, these diseases all have a shared set of impact they can have for patients. One, they tend to lead to an increase in the number of blood cells in the peripheral blood. And that can have consequences in terms of interfering with blood flow, development of symptoms, and risk of blood clots or bleeding. Two, they're diseases that can lead to enlargement of the spleen, which is a filter for the blood. And when the spleen is significantly enlarged, it can give patients a variety of difficulties, including discomfort or symptom. Three, there are diseases that can impact patients by making them have direct disease-related symptoms, such as weight loss, night sweats, or fevers. They can cause fatigue, they can cause itching. They are diseases that, as they progress, can cause a drop in the blood counts, and they can have a potential progression to the more acute diseases that Dr. Morrow discussed, the acute leukemias. So patients might have all of these things. They may have none of them for any combination. So the care for individuals needs to be very individualized. Now, with this, as you work with your provider in terms of understanding what disease you have, how is it impacting you, what is the risk for you in the future, the course with these diseases can be quite mixed. In some people, they can be very difficult. In other people, they are less problematic. Now, as physicians, we clearly then look to try to match, based on how the disease is impacting you, how do we best treat the diseases. And with this, at this year's ASH meeting, there were several important updates that is relevant. First, with patients with essential thrombocythemia or polycythemia vera, there's been a question, what is the best initial treatment we use to help control the blood counts when we use a medication? Historically, that medication has been hydroxyurea. There's been great interest in long-acting interferons, such as pegylated interferon, to try to have a more favorable impact on the disease. Two different clinical trials were presented with two slightly different formulations of long-acting interferon. The first, with pegylated interferon alpha-2A, or Pegasus, that agent compared to hydroxyurea in a trial actually looked very similar over the course of the first year. Similar in controlling counts, similar rates of preventing blood clots or bleeding, not too dissimilar a side effect profile. The second trial was with proline pegylated interferon alpha-2B done in Europe. That trial, just done in patients with polycythemia vera, also found that the drugs were equivalent through a year, but that after a longer period of time, there may be a better outcome with the pegylated interferon by helping to control the molecular disease better than the hydroxyurea. So what we can take away from this is, one, interferon was a good treatment. It potentially might be able to be used interchangeably with the hydroxyurea. I think we'll need longer-term follow-up to know, is it better than hydroxyurea, or is it just an equivalent substitute? We know as well that there are medications now, such as the JAK inhibitor ruxolitinib, that clearly can be used as second-line treatment in patients with polycythemia vera, and probably is preferred for individuals with an enlarged spleen for many difficult symptoms. Next, I would highlight new treatments potentially for myelofibrosis. Currently, we have ruxolitinib as the main approved treatment for that disease. And with that, there was data from their series ASH showing after 5 years of approval that it's a drug that can be favorable for patients in terms of improving survival, potentially improving scarring in the bone marrow, and is helpful. That being said, a limiter is that patients still can have challenges with anemia or low platelets. In that, the medication pacritinib was presented in a second-line study, in the PERSIST-2 study, in patients with a platelet count of less than 100,000. This drug has shown benefit in patients with low blood counts before, with improvements in spleen and symptoms. In the past, this drug had been put on an FDA hold because of concerns of bleeding with the use of this medicine. Now, it's difficult to interpret, was the bleeding seen on prior studies related to side effects of the medicine, or was it that these patients were more predisposed? The trial presented at ASH was very important in that it helped to demonstrate, one, that there's probably not a safety concern with pacritinib, it's just patients who had very advanced disease were being treated with the medicine. Two, suggestion as to what might be the right dose of the drug given a couple times a day as opposed to a larger dose once a day in terms of effectiveness and safety. The FDA has lifted the clinical hold, and there's likely to be another trial to try to finalize the path for approval for that medication. In parallel, there was updated information on other JAK inhibitors, including momelotinib and NS018 that have favorable data and are continuing to be evolved. There is not yet a second approved SAC inhibitor. There was additional information regarding ruxolitinib combinations, in particular with hypomethylating agents for people with more advanced disease, showing benefits both with azacitidine and decitidine. So it's a lot of information, a lot of things that are changing, and even some additional new drugs very early in testing I haven't had a chance to cover. With this, it highlights the importance of speaking with your healthcare team about your treatment options. In each of these diseases along the way, need to be mindful of what therapy you're on, understanding what are the goals, how long will you expect until you see a benefit from that therapy. If it's beneficial, what does that look like? If it's not beneficial, when do we make that decision, and how do we assess that? And if my therapy is not helpful, what is the next option available to me, or as has been raised on this teleconference already, should I be considering a clinical trial? Indeed, with myeloproliferative neoplasms as long-term chronic illnesses, that relationship between you and your healthcare team is really essential. It's a two-way combination as we're continually assessing, is the therapy helpful? Are there negatives? What are the alternatives? And is your disease evolving in any way? So with that, I certainly conclude, and with a message of hope, as we are hopeful with all of these great advances for the future of patients who have these diseases.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Nasra. That was really outstanding and really an honest summary of treatment of MPN, but also a wonderful call out to the conference of clinical trials and the communication consistently with one's healthcare team. So thank you. And I know there'll be questions for you during the hearing as well. Our next speaker is Dr. Nicole Roger. Dr. Roger is Associate Professor, Department of Medicine, Harvard Medical School, Director, Center for Multiple Myeloma, Division of Hematology and Oncology, Massachusetts General Hospital. Dr. Roger is going to present an overview of multiple myeloma, multiple myeloma-specific treatment and research updates from ASH, and quality of life concerns, including reducing complications of bone disease and pain management. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Roger.
Thank you so much, Carolyn. It is a real pleasure to be on this call today with my colleagues who have actually set the stage very nicely in some of the other hematologic cancers as to updates at ASH. What I will do over the next few minutes is focus on advances specifically in multiple myeloma in the recently concluded ASH meeting. To us, this has been a very, very exciting time in myeloma. As you are all aware, late last year, 2015, where we had four new drugs approved in the treatment of myeloma, and just at this ASH, around the time of ASH, we had two more combination approvals, which I will allude to later on. And as always, I think ASH is an extremely exciting meeting for multiple myeloma. This year was no different as well, and there were several very important presentations which I do think will help advance this field. A lot of new information that is important to both patients as well as caregivers, and these advances will in fact change how we approach taking care of people. And I think what we learned mostly from this year's ASH, which I will talk about in the next few minutes, is treatment with several new classes of drugs. And I think some of the themes which you've already heard from some of my other speakers on this panel include immunotherapy and cellular therapies as well. So in 2015 at ASH, we learned that three drugs induction treatment is considered standard of care. We compared that to two. We also learned that high-dose chemotherapy plus autologous transplantation should be considered standard of care for newly diagnosed patients, at least up to the age of 65. We also learned about an oral proteasome inhibitor called ixazomib, and there was data which was presented on monoclonal antibodies, including a drug called daratumumab. Now, this past December, I think we've extended our understanding of some of these issues, and there was a large trial which was presented in the transplant world, and this trial is called the Stamina Trial. And what the Stamina Trial did was ask the question of what should be the ideal optimal treatment post-transplantation. And patients were randomized three ways, wherein they post-transplantation, they would continue lenalidomide maintenance. You did hear about lenalidomide maintenance from Dr. Leonard earlier on, and also Dr. Maro and Lisa as well. Lenalidomide is a standard of care maintenance approach in myeloma. So the question here was, should one just continue maintenance lenalidomide? Should one use some kind of consolidation with that triplet, including lenalidomide, bortezomib, and dexamethasone? Or should we use a second transplant or a tandem transplant? And by doing a second transplant, will we have a better response? What was seen in this very large Stamina trial of more than 700 odd patients was the fact that it didn't matter how you consolidated post-transplant, all three arms did quite well, so that just continuing with maintenance should be considered the standard of care today. As I mentioned, in 2015, we did hear about daratumumab. What we heard about at this ASH was updated data on two trials called POLUX and CASTOR. The POLUX trial is daratumumab in combination with lenalidomide and dexamethasone. The CASTOR trial is daratumumab in combination with bortezomib and dexamethasone. Both of these combinations are used when the disease comes back, so that when you have relapse disease, and we have absolutely phenomenal responses in this patient population. And what was absolutely striking at this year's meeting was the fact that even in the relapse setting, we are getting to a level where we are able to see minimal residual disease negative situations in patients with myeloma. Now, those of you who are familiar with daratumumab know that daratumumab infusion times can take a while, and therefore this ASH we had a very interesting trial called the PAVO trial which was presented. And the PAVO trial essentially was a phase 1 trial which was looking at the use of daratumumab but given in a subcutaneous fashion by using recombinant human hyaluronidase. This is an enzyme which, if injected under the skin, allows you to absorb daratumumab easily, and by doing so, this infusion could in fact be given over 30 minutes, and with that, the side effect profile of daratumumab given in a subcutaneous fashion was very well tolerated. Most importantly, we saw the same kind of responses with single-agent daratumumab given in a subcutaneous fashion. What about newer classes of drugs? Well, you heard about venetoclax in the lymphomas as well as in the leukemias, and this is something we are borrowing from our lymphoid colleagues here. Venetoclax, as has been mentioned already, is a oral medication which can help cause death of cancer cells. And what was seen in myeloma here is when you combine venetoclax with bortezomib, we are seeing very high response rates in patients with multiple myeloma. What we also saw was, this was new drugs, but what about some old drugs which are traditionally used in the treatment of other diseases? And in this case, an HIV drug called nelsinavir, which is a protease inhibitor, was combined with bortezomib. Now, this was done in patients who were receiving bortezomib, but where bortezomib had stopped working. These investigators here then added in the nelsinavir, and by just addition of this new HIV drug, they were able to see responses in patients who were otherwise resistant to bortezomib, therefore a very big advance, as we know that a lot of our patients stop responding to drugs like bortezomib over time. Some of the other interesting drugs or drugs with new mechanisms of action included a drug called selinexor. Selinexor is an oral drug which inhibits certain proteins in the cells, which could in fact cause proliferation of tumor cells, and by doing so it causes cell death of these tumor cells. This has been combined, given alone with steroids, as well as combined with proteasome inhibitors, both carfilzomib as well as bortezomib, and very nice responses have been seen in patients who are refractory to all other therapies in multiple myeloma. So really a huge advance for patients who don't have a lot of options down there. There were some other interesting observations in that we have a target called BCMA that stands for B-cell maturation antigen. There were two different approaches which were presented at ASH this past year. One was the use of a monoclonal antibody against BCMA, and even in this phase one trial with this BCMA monoclonal antibody, we saw response rates of about 40 or 50%. When you look at patients who were getting cellular therapy, and I know Dr. Leonard talked a little bit about CAR T cells, and this was presented last year as well as again this year, we have CAR T cells which are engineered T cells against the same protein called BCMA. And again, I will reiterate what Dr. Leonard said. This is not treatment for everybody. It's a lot more complicated, this kind of therapy, but nonetheless has the potential of long-term disease control. There are side effects associated with it, but the data which was presented here was the feasibility of this approach, very nice responses in people who were getting this kind of cellular therapy, and long-lasting responses as well. So we had both monoclonal antibodies as well as cellular therapy strategies against the same antigen called B-cell maturation antigen. What about some of the other things that we look at in myeloma? And this year's ASH actually had interesting data on a related disease called amyloid. And in amyloid, there was another monoclonal antibody called NEOD001, N-E-O-D-001. And this, I do believe, is going to be a game changer in the treatment of amyloid disease, because this is a treatment which is given once a month for patients with amyloid, extremely well tolerated. And folks with amyloid had responses which were to the tune of 60 and 70%. So remarkable responses with a very well-tolerated treatment for this otherwise difficult-to-treat disease. And we're looking forward to seeing more data in this context. In terms of quality of life, I think most of these drugs we have now are generally well-tolerated. We know that most of the times with myeloma, we want to keep patients on treatment for prolonged periods of time. We saw some data in kidney disease with myeloma where we have new filters so that we could actually better treat myeloma-related kidney disease also. And these are, again, huge advances in the treatment not just of myeloma, but some of the complications associated with myeloma. So as with every year, I think this has been an exciting year in multiple myeloma research with, I do believe, direct impact on patient care, and we are very, very hopeful that this year is going to be even better. So thank you very much for your attention.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Rajay, and thank you also for giving such a really such an important update, really, on the treatment of myeloma and all of the progress that's been made. So thank you, and it's very helpful to everyone who's listening. And our next speaker is Ms. Caroline Edlin. Ms. Edlin is an oncology social worker, and she is our online support group program director for cancer care. And Ms. Edlin will present on cancer care's free psychosocial services and programs and the role of support groups. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Ms. Edlin.
Thank you, Caroline. It's a pleasure to be part of the call today. And I'd like to start by speaking about the importance of creating a support network when you're diagnosed with cancer and how cancer care can be a part of that network. There are many ways that we can help. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization that provides free professional supportive services to anyone affected by cancer. Cancer care programs include individual counseling, support groups, education about resources and how to navigate the healthcare system, practical help and some limited financial assistance. All of our services are delivered by master's level oncology social workers and are completely free of charge. Oncology social workers are trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and his or her family and friends, and are experienced in helping people to manage the emotional, physical, and financial challenges that arise after a diagnosis. Adjusting to and dealing with a diagnosis is an important part of the healing process. Asking for help by joining a support group or by contacting a social worker for counseling is a sign of strength. Cancer Care offers face-to-face groups in our local offices in the New York City area, as well as telephone and online support groups. These groups offer a unique opportunity to connect with other people impacted by cancer, along with the help of a cancer care social worker to facilitate the group. Sharing information and understanding with others in similar situations can be a powerful experience. Group members offer encouragement and a sense of community that can provide you with additional support and guidance. These connections help lessen the isolation that many people with cancer experience. As we've learned from today's program, there's a lot of information to digest and make sense of. Our social workers can help you understand what this means for you and for your family. A cancer care social worker can help you prioritize and consider the questions you might want to ask to get the answers and information you need. Please remember that you are not alone. Cancer care services are here to help. So please do feel free to contact us at 1-800-813-HOPE or 4673, or log on to our website at www.cancercare.org for more information about our oncology social work support. And thank you for your attention and the opportunity to speak today.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Edelman. That was wonderful. And now we do have time for questions, and we're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. And if you don't get to all of your questions, because there are so many of you on the call today, then I will actually give you instructions at the end of the call of how to get your questions answered. But for now, I'm going to ask Stephanie to explain to you how to queue up the questions, and then we'll let the questions begin. Okay. Stephanie?
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. If you would like to ask a question, please press star then 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Again, to ask a question, please press star then 1 on your touch-tone telephone.
Also, we'll bring all of our speakers on board, so everyone's all set to answer these questions, so it's fantastic. And we do have a question from one of our online participants who's been lining up to ask questions. So we have one as a general question. I'm going to direct this question. I'll start with Dr. Leonard, and then others may wish to add to it. As a newer oncology healthcare professional, I was wondering if there was a set professional opinion on the use of probiotics with oncology patients, with special regards to those with weakened immune systems or low white blood cell counts. So, Dr. Leonard, could you comment on this in a general way? And then, of course, this would have to be customized to each person's situation, but the general question that you could address.
Yeah, so the idea of probiotics comes up sometimes, particularly in patients getting chemotherapy or antibiotic therapy, who have issues around their gastrointestinal tract. They may have diarrhea, there may be concerns about infections, and the concept is that the bacteria that normally live in the gastrointestinal tract, the intestines, may change over time, that the nature of those bacteria, which we all normally have, might have some influence over our digestive health and our risk of infections and relating to our gastrointestinal tract, and these can change as we take antibiotics, as patients take antibiotics, or as patients get chemotherapy and other treatments. And so there's some thought that these probiotics, these supplements that are taken that can change the bacteria in the gastrointestinal tract might work in a more favorable way. And I would say it's very difficult to generalize whether or not these are of particular value or not. I think there are some suggestions that they can be for some patients, although it's a little bit challenging to study in the more rigorous fashions that we study some of our treatments. And this is very dependent upon the nature of the patient, meaning patients who may be getting a bone marrow transplant or leukemia treatment where their blood counts may be low for weeks to months at a time, may have a different overall situation and immune system and immune risk to patients with, say, lymphoma who may, in some cases, only have low blood counts for a few days at a time. And so I think it's a really individualized situation, but certainly if anyone else wants to make any more specific comments, they should feel free amongst the panel.
Anyone else like to comment on this question?
Sure, I could certainly comment. I think the point John raised, I think, is appropriate. I think if patients who are profoundly immunocompromised is probably the biggest issue, post-allotransplant, induction chemotherapy for acute leukemia, profound neutropenia. I suspect for others, it's probably less of a concern, but clearly something to discuss with your physicians. But I suspect the main concern is in profoundly immunocompromised patients.
Yeah, and I would just add to that, Carolyn, I agree with everything which has already been said, of course, but I think what we end up seeing specifically in patients who are on chronic doses of some of the medications we've been talking about, specifically drugs like the IMiDs, lenalidomide, we tend to see GI-related side effects in years 2 and 3, and a lot of our patients will ask us about using probiotics. I don't think there's a contraindication to using them, as has been mentioned by both Dr. Mehta as well as Dr. Leonard. You know, these are not patients like transplant patients or patients post-induction chemotherapy, and therefore using probiotics in that setting certainly does help with those chronic GI-related side effects that we see with drugs like lenalidomide.
Thank you. And I would have one of our questions from someone on the telephone. Stephanie?
We have a question from William B. Your line is open.
Yes, I have indolent follicular lymphoma confined to the abdomen and pelvis, and I'm about to undergo an endoscopic cholecystectomy. There are 3 to 4 centimeter easily approachable intra-abdominal lymph nodes. Should one or more be removed and genome sequenced and pharmacologically or pharmacogenomically studied for more precision-type treatment?
Well, thank you very much, William, for that excellent question. I'm going to ask Dr. Leonard if you could address this question in a general way, and then we hope, William, you could take this back to your healthcare team.
Sure. So there are lots of opportunities at many academic centers and in commercial companies, and even in the community in some locations where patients can get their tumor tissue, what we call sequenced or profiled, and I'm sure many patients have either experience of hearing about that and maybe asking their doctor. It's certainly a common question. I would say that is something that really you need to talk to your doctor individually about, because there are certain types of genetic testing, and I would say, for example, although not exclusively, some of the testing done in leukemias, particularly acute leukemias, can be very, very helpful in establishing whether or not a treatment's going to work or not. Certainly some of the areas Dr. Mehta talked about, with looking at myeloproliferative disorders and looking at certain genetic testing. On the other hand, in lymphomas, while there are a limited number of genetic tests and there are lots of genetic tests we can do, just because we can do a genetic test doesn't necessarily mean that information is something that we know what to do with. It may or may not be useful in establishing someone's diagnosis. And I would say certainly for lymphomas, more often than not, it doesn't tell us what to do as far as therapy. And at the end of the day, the vast majority of therapies are going to be driven not by a genetic test somewhere that shows some mutation in the tumor, but really from the clinical trials we've talked about that have really focused on testing these treatments in patients where they've been well studied in parallel and characterized, so we know what types of tumors patients have. So I think that this is a very important area. I think patients, when they think about this or hear about genetic testing or profiling, it shouldn't be an automatic thing that you do it, but really talk to your doctor and say, what's the chance that this is going to add value to my care? And certainly in some cases, this is a rapidly changing thing, and it may be that someone who doesn't need their tumor profiled now because it's not useful may be useful in 5 years. And it's important to keep in mind that you might want to save your tumor for 5 years, but on the other hand, your tumor might be different in 5 years. And therefore, you know, testing a tumor that you had 5 years ago, which is different than what you have now, may or may not be of value. So a very individualized thing in most cases, I would say, is of some limited value, but again, in some cases, quite important value to talk to your doctor.
So that's helpful, and thank you so much, Dr. Leonard, and William, I hope that will help you. And we have a question from our online participants for Dr. Morrow. So I'd like to know if there are stages of leukemia, what is the likelihood of remission for a 75-year-old diabetic male other than chemo? Are there other treatment options? This is a very complicated question. So, of course, we're going to ask our colleague to go back to the Treating Healthcare team, but if Dr. Morrow, if you could provide some general guidelines, this is for the question about a possible remission for a 75-year-old diabetic male other than chemo. Are there other treatment options in terms of just the different stages of leukemia?
Sure. So I think the first part of the question was about leukemia diagnosis stages. Leukemia is generally considered a systemic disease, so when it's present, it can be more involved. There are stages in CLL, but not in acute leukemia or ALL, and AML, or CML. There are phases of CML. So there's the answer to that first part. But I really want to focus on the second part, and that we realize that many of the patients that we need to treat may not have the ability to withstand the side effects of what people consider standard chemotherapy. And chemotherapy is a very broad term. Chemotherapy nowadays is a drug or a chemical that's used to treat leukemia. And I can say gladly that a lot of our efforts in acute myeloid leukemia, which may be at the diagnosis question, are focused on how to treat someone who may not have the good health they had in younger years, or even folks who are still early in life but have other health conditions, in order to minimize that effects and treat the cancer better, smarter. So I definitely would say there's a lot of research and a lot of opportunity for someone, even if they're 75, even if they have diabetes, to successfully control, to treat, maybe even to potentially cure kinds of leukemia. So I would encourage a careful review of the plus and the minuses of the options available.
Thank you so much, Dr. Morrow. And Denise, I hope that's helpful to you as you can consult with your physician, your treating healthcare team, with information that there are options for you, and that's really important. I have to say this has been a remarkable call today with lots of I know there are many more questions. I want to thank our speakers. They've just been remarkable. I want to thank all of our speakers for being on this call today and providing their expertise and information to everyone. I also want to thank all of you who've been on this call today with asking such really excellent questions, and also just and all of you who've been listening. Now, there are questions that we haven't gotten to, so I first want to address those of you who have a question that has not yet been addressed. So if you have a medical question that you actually would like to get more information about its treatment, of course we recommend you go back to your treating healthcare team. However, there is also the option of contacting the National Cancer Institute. They have information specialists, and they have information about every type of cancer. So there are two ways to reach them. One is an 800 number, 1-800-422-6237, and this will be sent out to all of you and all of your materials, or has been already, but we're going to resend it again with the evaluation. So again, it's 1-800-422-6237. And you also can visit their website, www.cancer.gov. They have a live chat feature, which is really nice for people both in the U.S. and internationally. You can pose your question, and then they will actually respond to you. So it's a very nice way to get some information that will help you as you then approach your own healthcare team about the questions you would like to have asked. Although some of you have, of course, been curious about where should you be treated for your specialty, types of the different types of blood cancers that you may have. And again, the National Cancer is a wonderful resource to you to contact in terms of where you're currently being treated and if there are places nearby that might be available also as perhaps a designated center of excellence in your United States or internationally that could actually provide some additional help in the care of your treatment. Now, if any of you also would like to take advantage of the services of Cancer Care, again, you can call Cancer Care at 1-800-813-4673 and ask to speak with one of our oncology social workers here, or to access all of the different services that that Ms. Edlin reviewed with all of you, or you can visit, come to our website, www.cancercare.org, and you can pose a question there. There's an opportunity to ask a question and to be connected to our international participants who may have concerns. You can actually use our website to get in touch with people here. And there's a when you get to the website, you'll be able to see how to do that. And I want to thank all of you for your participation today. And I guess most importantly, we don't want anyone to leave this call feeling that you're alone. We want you to now know that you're part of the Cancer Care community, and as such, you can contact us at any time. And you also, of course, do have your healthcare team. We do not wish to take the place of your healthcare team. We want you to use your healthcare team, but we also want you to know that you can also speak to our staff here for the emotional, practical, and a social support that might be useful to you. So, again, I want to thank you all for your participation today. And I do want to mention to all of you that we have an interesting program coming up on March 6th on managing eye and vision changes related to cancer treatments. And some of you might be interested in that. You'll be getting information about all of our upcoming programs, but that might be one that might be of interest to some of you. Okay, well, I want to thank you all, and I want to wish you all a very fine day.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may now disconnect, and everyone have a wonderful day.